The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
One of the big issues of the day today is whether or not to build the Keystone Pipeline. Environmentalists say it would hurt the environment. Others, such as governors, unions, and the oil industry, say it'll help to bring down the cost of production. Joining me on the program is Jeff Rubin, author of The End of Growth. Jeff, let's talk about the Keystone Pipeline. It's been debated. I don't know how many studies have been done on it, but there was one released by the State Department, and it would seem the pipeline should move forward. At least there's nothing holding it back. What is holding this pipeline back?
Well, I think the technical issue right now are some state court challenges in the state of Nebraska. But the bigger picture is that I think the role of Canadian bitumen in the U.S. marketplace has changed dramatically, and it's lost much of its initial attraction. Its drawing card has always been that it was a secure source of supply from a friendly neighboring country and would replace a supply from problematic sources like the Middle East and Venezuela. Of course, the world has changed in the last 4 to 5 years thanks to the shale revolution in the United States and the huge increases in domestic oil production. And now, all of a sudden, Canadian bitumen is the odd man out. That the U.S. is already exporting about 3 to 3.5 million barrels a day of processed oil in the form of gasoline and diesel, and doesn't really need the supply. And when you consider all the environmental opposition to it, I think it tips the scales for President Obama, and he'll use whatever pretext he needs to endlessly delay approval. I should point out that the Keystone XL pipeline was proposed some 7 years ago, and now looks like we won't see a decision for at least another year.
Jeff, there's been talk that if the U.S. wouldn't go through with this, that Canada would simply build a pipeline to the West Coast and just ship it to China.
Well, they are, in fact, trying to do that. And, Jim, you should understand one thing, that, you know, while the Keystone XL pipeline is a necessary condition for oil sands expansion, it's by no means a sufficient condition. The oil sand producers in Alberta want to ramp up production from about 2 million barrels a day to 5 million barrels a day. To do that, they'll need not one Keystone XL, but 4 to 5 Keystone XL. And, you know, given the fact that it's, as I say, almost been a decade to get one approved, I think they're now concentrating on domestic pipelines to carry the load. There are not just a couple that are proposed to go to the West Coast, but TransCanada Pipeline, the same company that would build Keystone XL, is proposing a much bigger 1.1 million barrel a day pipeline that would take oil from Alberta all the way to the Irving Refinery in St. John, New Brunswick. That's a pretty circuitous route to get oil to a world market. But, you know, going forward, it's increasingly problematic to get pipelines approved. And, you know, I'll point out that the same groups that are against Keystone XL in the United States tend to be against the pipeline proposals in British Columbia, one of which would go through a very environmentally pristine area to get to Kitimat in northern BC.
Let me ask you this. We've seen a number of accidents here with trains transporting oil. We know, Jeff, that it is much cheaper to transport oil through a pipeline because I forget what it is, whether it's $20 a barrel or whatever the cost is, to transport oil by train versus a pipeline. So you would think just from the economics that pipelines would be more on the approval list than they are today.
Well, certainly that argument is being made by pipeline companies that de facto what has happened is that instead of keeping oil in the ground, which is what environmentalists who oppose pipelines want, that it's put it on rail. There was, of course, one opponent of Keystone XL that had other ideas. I speak here of the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, because when he came out against Keystone XL, instead of ringing around the White House in protest, he bought Burlington Santa Fe, and then he bought Procar, which are the leasing companies that leased .111 tanker cars to railways. And then he went and bought 18 million shares of Suncor. So clearly his intention was not to keep oil in the ground, but rather to load it on rail cars. And that's basically what's happened. You know, there has been exponential growth in rail shipments on both sides of the border. And it's become a concern. It's become a concern because the more oil that's shipped, the more accidents we had. We had, of course, a tragic accident in Lac-Mégantic in Quebec, where 76 people died and half of the downtown core got incinerated. We've had subsequent explosions in rural Alabama and in North Dakota, and we just had one a week ago in Virginia. So it's only a matter of time. I'll point out that a tremendous amount of those .111 100 car tanker trains run right through Toronto and Chicago. In fact, the one that exploded in Lac-Mégantic ran through Toronto, and the one that recently exploded in Virginia went through Chicago. You know, you start carrying 2-3 million barrels a day of crude on rail in North America, one of these days you're going to have it explode in the wrong place. And I think that will be a game-changing event, both for oil companies and specifically for railways.
Is it going to take a tragedy like that, Jeff, where finally there will be some kind of political cover to push through the pipelines? Because, I mean, Buffett's opposition to Keystone, then he buys railroads, he buys leasing companies. It sounds like crony capitalism.
Well, it is. Now, I mean, he was unusual. All the other people who were protesting against pipelines wanted to keep the oil in the ground, and I'm sure it wasn't their intention to move it on rail. But rail has become the option and has regained a prominence in the oil industry that it didn't have since the days of the industry's first years of Standard Oil and Rockefeller. You know, I just don't think that this is really going to be sustainable. It's an even bigger problem, not just for the oil sand producers, but it's an even bigger problem for the shale producers in places like the Bakken in North Dakota. We're now almost 90%, and they're producing close to 1 million barrels a day, is being moved by rail car. As I say, much of it through Chicago.
You know what this reminds me of? Jeff, it reminds me of the 19th century when the railroad barons tried to squeeze Rockefeller, and he said, you know what, I'll show you, and he built pipelines and nearly put the railroads out of business.
Right. Well, now it's the environmentalists squeezing the pipelines and putting the railways in business. But, you know, there are a lot of issues in that. I mean, one of the issues, particularly in Canada, but also in Dakota as well, is that last year was a bumper wheat crop. And railways, like all transport systems, are finite. They can only carry so much capacity. And when you have, like, you know, a 40 times increase in rail shipments over the last 3 years, a whole bunch of farmers have their wheat still in storage bins around the prairies and can't get their product out to market. So created a whole chain reaction of consequences. But nevertheless, railways are going to play an even larger role. Even with the approval of Keystone XL, not that I'm saying that it's going to be approved, but even if it was approved, the nameplate capacity of 830,000 barrels a day is a fraction, and I want to emphasize the word a fraction, of the throughput capacity that's going to be needed to facilitate the huge expansion in production from the oil sands as well as from shale formations like the Bakken.
Jeff, you know, you're talking about some of the unintended consequences, some of the accidents that have happened now when you're shipping more oil through rail. Secondly, if the railroads are shipping more oil, you've got a backlog of grain that needs to be shipped from silos.
That's right.
So there are all kinds of consequences there. And one of them has been this shale oil play has changed the energy dynamics in the U.S. considerably. I mean, you know, 6-7 years ago, we were talking about peak conventional oil production until shale came along. Now, the U.S. is exporting finished petroleum products like gasoline and diesel. I mean, that's a remarkable turnaround and a major game changer, not to mention the impact on oil sands.
It certainly has. And I mean, just to give you an idea of how much, you know, you mentioned 2005. I mean, the U.S. was producing almost down to 5 million barrels a day. Now it's producing over 8. And according to the International Energy Agency, within the next 2 years may even surpass Saudi and Russia. And that's certainly changed the name of the game, particularly for the oil sand producers, because 99% of their sales are going into the U.S. market. So all of a sudden, that market is not quite the panacea that they thought that it was. For the U.S., I mean, there are many issues. I mean, one of the most obvious issues is the law right now that was enacted after the first OPEC oil shock in 1975 that prohibits the export of crude other than to Canada. And that law was done in the interest of safeguarding energy security. Now, the American Petroleum Association is lobbying actively for its repeal. Ironically, while there are restrictions on exporting crude, there are no restrictions on refining that crude into petroleum or diesel and then exporting the finished product. And that's exactly what U.S. refineries are doing on both the East and Western Gulf Coast. And to the point where the U.S. is now exporting something like 3.5 million barrels a day. And because it would receive its feedstock prices a lot cheaper, I mean, at one point, Canadian bitumen was as much as $50 a barrel cheaper than world oil prices. American refineries have put a lot of other refineries out of business, particularly in the Atlantic Basin. How long this restriction will stay preventing crude from being exported is anybody's guess. But, you know, don't forget it was the environmentalists who first argued that this oil coming down from Canada wouldn't be burnt by American motorists. It would just be re-exported. And if what's happening to the light oil coming out of the Bakken is any guide, they're going to be absolutely correct.
Let's talk about another game changer as well, and that's what's happening to the coal industry. Now, there's been some new environmental regulations coming out of the EPA that make it almost virtually impossible to build a new coal plant. Some are going to be closing down economically, and the fact that natural gas is cheaper.
Right. Well, I think you hit the nail on the head with your third point, because I don't think any of those other things would have happened if not for the shale gas revolution. I mean, one of the reasons that Obama has used the Clean Air Act to get the EPA to raise the bar is that it's not going to have an appreciable impact on utility bills for American households. I could guarantee you that if gas was still $9 per million British thermal units instead of $3 to $4, that director from the White House would not have been given to the Environmental Protection Agency, because then it would have resulted in an increase in power bills for U.S. households. The fact of the matter is that even without putting a price on carbon emissions, coal is no longer competitive with natural gas in North America, and that's an important caveat, to generate power. And coal plants have been closed right and left. We've already seen, you know, coal drop from over 40% to now less than 30% of power generation in the U.S., and that trend will continue as long as natural gas trades in these ranges. It's true that the new legislation coming out in 2017 will effectively preclude new coal plants from being built unless they have carbon capture and sequestration, and there's only one plant being built in Mississippi that has that technology and only with public money. But, of course, existing plants will still be able to continue. But if you're looking at coal prices, you know, what's happened to thermal coal prices or metallurgical coal prices, the huge declines that we've seen over the last 2 years have a lot less to do with what's happening in the United States and interestingly, a lot more to do with what's happening in China.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I think it's 2/3 of Chinese electricity comes from coal-fired generating plants. We've seen two things, Jeff. One, we're not seeing the explosive double-digit economic growth of the last decade. So obviously, with slower economic growth comes less demand for energy. But also, they had serious pollution problems. Everybody remembers the Olympics, where they had to shut down the city for 6 months just to clean up the air so the athletes could breathe.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, coal has been the fuel of the Chinese economy. It powers something close to 80% of power generation in China. And coal demand in China was typically growing at 10% a year for the last decade. China last year combusted almost 4 billion tons of coal, which is 10 times what the U.S. did and as much as the rest of the world put together. So if you own a coal stock, you're going to be keeping your eyes on what's happening in China. First, as you point out, the deceleration in economic growth from 10% to 7% is obviously going to leave a big footprint on coal markets when so much of the Chinese economy is powered by coal. But above and beyond, something else is happening. China, who's never really accepted any responsibility for global emissions or global warming, it's always argued that's a rich country's problem, and most of the emissions since the Industrial Revolution have come from those countries anyway, is suddenly taking a huge change of course. And it's not any sense of international responsibility to Kyoto-type agreement. It's rather the airpocalypse that is now strangling its city. And I'm not talking about remote rural places like Inner Mongolia. I'm talking about Beijing and Shanghai, where the environment is becoming a national health problem. Particulate readings in Beijing or Shanghai are typically multiples of world health standards. In fact, in March, there are many days where parents were advised not to let their children outside because readings were 8 times world health standards. It got so bad that in December, they had to close Pudong Airport in Shanghai, which is the world's third busiest airport, because of zero visibility. 16% of the land in China is already so polluted that it's unfit for human use. And I think that what we're seeing from the Chinese leadership is a new direction. It's a new direction in response to the demands of people living in its principal city. It's easy for us in the West to be dismissive of China's new war on smog, but I will point out that when the Chinese leadership elevates an issue to national importance, they have the wherewithal to deliver on that in a way that simply would be unfathomable in a Western democracy. For example, if we want to talk about sort of environmental measures, even last year, Beijing simply shut down 50 smog-polluting firms. They've already mandated that by 2017, the number of coal-fired plants in and around Beijing will be cut in half. Can you see the EPA doing the same kind of measures in the United States?
Not really.
Not really. And so, you know, Chinese coal consumption has decelerated from 10% to 3%. They say that within the next 3 to 4 years, they're going to halt the increase in coal demand growth completely. I think, you know, if we've already seen thermal coal prices, if we sort of use the Newcastle coal price, Newcastle is the largest thermal coal exporting terminal in the world. It's in Australia, and most of the shipments go to China. Prices have already fallen from about $142 a ton in early 2011 to less than $80 a ton. The next thing you know, coal mines from Australia to Canada are being shut down. Goldman Sachs estimates that right now marginal production costs are probably 15% higher than prices for thermal coal and about 20% higher for metallurgical coal. So, you know, if you look at what's happened to coal stocks, like the KOL index, which is probably as good as any exchange traded fund that sort of proxies the performance of the world coal industry. It's gone from $50 a unit, again, early 2011, to around $18 a unit. And if China is serious about what it says it's going to be doing, you know, thermal coal prices may fall all the way back to $40, $50 where they were in 2000, in which case the shrinkage in the coal industry to date is nothing compared to what lies ahead.
It's amazing, Jeff, when we look at where we are today compared to where we were in 2005. And I think it says a lot about the energy industry itself and its ability to innovate, whether it's fracking or shale plays, horizontal drilling. It's really changed energy dynamics. You remember this a couple of years ago. What was it in the mid-00 decade where we saw nat gas prices go over $10? And then we saw them go all the way down to two. So a real major change.
That's a very interesting point, Jim, because, you know, I'll tell you something. In the United States and in Canada, there's a mad rush to build LNG plants and export all this cheap shale gas. Because, as you know, gas trades three times as much in Europe as it does in North America and five times as much in Asia. And the reason for that is precisely what you just mentioned, technological change, hydraulic fracking, the ability to apply fracking to shale deposits. And I guess LNG is a way of arbitraging that spread. But let me just say a cautionary tale. I remember when I was still chief economist at CIBC World Markets, it was around 2007, that there was going to be an LNG terminal built around Quebec City to receive Russian LNG from Gazprom. And back in those days, as you point out, gas was $8, $9 in North America, and people were concerned about depletion of conventional gas. Then, of course, the shale revolution happened. Gas prices plunged to $4, and the notion of importing LNG from Russia became absurd given relative prices. But bear in mind that shale gas deposits exist all around the world. They're not the exclusive domain of the United States and Canada, even though those are the only two countries that really, on a commercial scale, employ fracking. China, as it turns out, has probably as large shale gas reserves, maybe even potentially larger, than the United States. I guess the obvious question is, instead of importing LNG from halfway around the world from places like California or British Columbia, why won't China go ahead and develop its own shale gas reserve using fracking technology? And why wouldn't the shale gas revolution in China have the same dramatic impact on reducing natural gas prices there as it's had in North America? You know, by the time we build all these natural gas pipelines to the coast and all these compressor stations to liquefy it, that's precisely what's probably going to happen.
Well, it's amazing how the dynamics of the industry have changed in just a short period of time. And really, shale, horizontal drilling and fracking has been one of the biggest game changers we've seen in energy. It's changing what power plants will be burning here. And also, Jeff, what do you think also as we move further away from energy? I mean, most of the major car manufacturers now are coming out with hybrid cars, electric cars. The success of Tesla is doing rather well. What about that, about the demand for oil?
Well, you know, the demand for oil in the United States is dropping and will continue to decline, mainly because over two-thirds of oil consumed is used as a transit fuel. And while there has been a huge recovery in car sales and in car production, some of it being financed by the taxpayer, nevertheless, what we're seeing is people are driving less, and what we're seeing is less and less people are getting their license. For example, a recent study by the University of Michigan showed that whereas, you know, in the 1980s, less than 10% of 19-year-old Americans didn't have their license, today that number is over 30%. And I think that as Americans end their longstanding love relationship with their automobile, we're going to find that U.S. oil consumption is going to continue to decline, much in the way it has in Western Europe.
Well, all they have to do is get stuck on an L.A. freeway or the freeways here in California, and that'll cure you of driving.
Yeah, and the other point being that, you know, for all the huge increases in production, it's not exactly like people are filling up at the pump at $2 a gallon, okay? Oil prices by any historic standard are still high, and I think that that over time had an impact on, you know, people's willingness to drive, and as you point out, on what kind of cars car producers are making, that hybrids are becoming the new normal.
Well, it's amazing how things change and how just a few inventions have changed the dynamics of the energy industry, not just here in the United States, but globally. Well, listen, Jeff, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work you put out, how can they do so?
Well, I have a blog in the Globe and Mail in Canada and Huffington Post in the United States, and I'll be publishing another book by Random House in May 2015. Called The Carbon Bubble, and I look forward to talking to you about that in the future.
All right, Jeff. Well, listen, as always, thanks for coming on the program, and all the best to you, sir, and with that new book.
Thanks. My pleasure.
Some interesting points in that interview. I think probably the biggest point is how the shale revolution is changing the dynamics of the energy industry. You talked about the impact in that interview on the Canadian oil sands at one time when oil prices were over $100 a barrel. The oil sands were looked upon as a cheap, dependable source of energy for the United States. That changed, obviously, with the shale oil revolution, which is also changing how electricity is going to be produced as we find more natural gas plants will be replacing those coal-fired plants. It'll just be simply too expensive to build one with all the EPA regulations. And then it's not just that we have EPA regulations here that are harming the coal industry, but it's also what's going on in China. You heard Jeff talking about the pollution is so bad in many Chinese cities where it's not actually safe to go outside and breathe. So a lot of new interesting dynamics that are coming to the energy industry. It is one of our favorite sectors to invest in right now, and you're seeing that in the performance of the stock market this year. You know, despite all the things that we talked about, this society that we live in still runs on carbon fuels. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.